My name is Syed Hassan, and I'm with South Asia Democracy Watch. We are here with Professor Amartya Sen, a Nobel laureate, a humanist, a scholar, and an activist. We have heard from Amartya Sen in several interviews through YouTube or some other medium. Professor Amartya Sen is a great name, a big scholar, and revolutionary in his activism, also in his teaching and his in real life. So we will start our conversation with Professor Amartya Sen today. Is I know a little background because some of the names that he mentioned in his biography is very familiar to me. Sir, you were born in Dhaka, East Pakistan. At that time, it was India, became East Pakistan, then became Bangladesh. So this transition you saw, how do you see it? The transition where the same place turned three times.
That's a very interesting question, and I think the spirit of the question is right. But in fact, I wasn't born in Dhaka. Mm-hmm. I was born in Shantiniketan. I was born in my mother's family house. And my grandfather was teaching in Shantiniketan. And in those days, the convention was that the first child of a couple typically were born in the mother's place. And I give a sociological interpretation that the woman's family didn't trust the man's family sufficiently to allow their daughter to be to go into that rather exacting process of giving birth there. So I came from Dhaka at the age of minus 2 months.
Okay.
Went from Dhaka to Shantiniketan. Okay. My mother heavily pregnant, I imagine. And then at age of plus 2 months, I returned to my native city, which is Dhaka. But your question is just right. Dhaka, for example, has gone through several changes. Mm-hmm. And I've been there, of course, throughout at different times. I was there last in February. But it has, at that time, of course, Dhaka was as much a part of India as Shantiniketan was. But and I think it's not often recognized that the whole partition movement didn't have roots in Dhaka until very late. In fact, the Muslim League never won an election in Bengal until 1946,
sure,
the year before the partition. At the time of when my consciousness about the West Bengal government, Bengal government, United, became strong, the chief minister was Fazlul Haq, a Muslim, but a leader of a secular party,
sure,
namely the Peasants' Party. But what happened was there was a kind of wave of communal violence and tension that began like early 1940s, and it continued through the partition and independence. And there was bloodbath in different parts of Bengal. And for something where this had not been a big factor at all, mm-hmm, it was a major thing that it could take so many lives. And then about after 47 and partition, by 1952, Bengalis were engaged in asserting their Bengali identity, Bengali language, Bengali culture, in which the Hindu-Muslim distinction was very minor, and in fact, to the extent it existed, it's like a personal life issue, not a political. Mm-hmm. The religious politics withdrew almost entirely from that, step by step, excepting for a long time it was kept in the military, in the way it was kept in Pakistan, too. I mean, Pakistan, some of the problems today arises from the fact that at the time of the Zia regime, mm-hmm, that was installed into the civil government, which didn't happen because the Zia regime came after Bangladesh or East Pakistan had separated already, and they never went through that. and the Bengali Bangladeshi army doesn't have a particular interest in the religious issue at all, in fact, which is probably the biggest difference. You know, when I talk with my Pakistani friend, I think they want to harm from the religious extremism point of view, as well as the military's role in it and generating militancy of a kind that makes life so difficult to live in Pakistan now. It had much to do with the military taking on the job of making religion not only official, but enormously present in life. You see, it's odd because there was, it began, if you think about the Muslim League, Jinnah's demands were fair deal for Muslims, but they didn't want an Islamic society in any sense.
Yeah.
And as a hard-drinking, whiskey-favoring Muslim, I don't think he would have particularly liked that either. I think that changed, and that changed gradually. Partly the logic of the partition generated that change. Bengali was quite different in some ways, and throughout history this had been different. I mean, if you go back to, say, the last Bengal king, Siraj Dowla, when in 1756 he was defeated by Lord Clive. Lord Clive, but General Clive, I guess, he's marching towards Murshidabad, which is the capital.
Yes.
On the way, Plassey was the battle. But he's writing letters to the Siraj, to the Emperor Siraj, saying, look, I mean peace, etc. I mean, he was lying. I mean, Clive was lying through his teeth. But he didn't want Siraj to be prepared. But he said, consult your closest allies and friends, and you will find that they also agree that we ought to have peace rather than you fight me. Even though he is moving with the British Army or the East India Company Army on the way. But the interesting point is he names seven of the closest friends of Siraj on his advice, he realized, four of whom are Hindu. And three are Muslim.
Same with Mughals also.
Mughals too, but Mughal, you see, there was a straightforward attempt by Akbar in particular. And then to a great extent that was pursued by other Mughals, not so much Aurangzeb, but Shah Jahan certainly.
Most of the Mughals, their mothers were Hindu.
Yeah, I don't think that played such a big part, you know. I think it played up to some extent. It sort of reduces Akbar saw himself as a Muslim. And indeed, those who were critical of him did say that he did lead a Muslim life, excepting that he thought that, A, as a leader of a multicultural, multi-religious nation, the state has to be equidistant from different religions. So Akbar actually defined what in India we now call secularism, and Bangladesh too. Which is not secularism in the European sense, which shuns all religion, but equidistant. In fact, in Bangladesh, in official ceremonies I've attended, it's a 92% Muslim. The remaining 8%, the Hindus, the Christian, and Buddhists. But in the official ceremonies, they have 2 minutes of Quran, 2 minutes of Bhagavad Gita, 2 minutes of Buddhist Tripitaka, and 2 minutes of the Bible. Now, that is the Akbarian way of understanding secularism, which is not European secularism, that is nothing to do with religion. So I think that Akbar, I mean, I resist usually when people say, well, his mother was a Hindu and so on. I think it underestimates the amount of revolution of thought he went through and introduced. Now, Siraj has a different kind of history, because I don't think this was a big issue in Bengal. Really wasn't. And that you see Bengali literature throughout. No one has, you know, next to Rabindranath Tagore.
The most secular literature we find is in Bengal.
In Bengal, I mean, the early Bengali as it starts out, the earliest Bengali are Buddhist. And then there's some Hindu thing, the Muslim thing. And if you think of the second most well-known literary writer, the second most well-known poet in Bengal, after Rabbi Noam Artigo, Nazrul Islam.
Yes.
He's absolutely emphatic on that point. So I think in some ways it was a hard job for Bengal to go that way. Even the 38th election, Congress had an absolute overwhelming majority in Bengal, though it was a more than two-thirds Muslim. It's a short period it went, and then the kind of the madness went away. And then now if you go there, I mean, mostly now it's a question of whether extreme Islamists should be executed or not. That's the main issue. It's a very different issue from Bengal. And actually it worries me sometimes against a capital punishment to see the very strong secularists in Bangladesh dancing with joy when some of the recently an Islamist was executed, and I would not. So that's really a different kind of issue.
Sure.
So I think that present, that Bengali culture was present very much in my childhood all around. But then came the riot, and I did see a Muslim laborer being knifed just outside home, and he came into our home, and I was the first person to see him, and he was lying on my lap. I was, I guess, 9 or 10, I think. I think I was 11, and I was asking for water, and I gave him some water, and my father took him to hospital where he died. But that seemed like a kind of, as a young child, it seemed like an incredible thing. I didn't know why. I tend to ask my father, this person who knifed, did they have something against him? No, he didn't have anything against him. Mm-hmm. They didn't even know who he was. Why did they knife him? So it was a terrifying experience.
So in your life experience made you more humanist, because typically economists are generally, they're more, they keep themselves away from emotions. But I mean, in your personality, we see a humanist. You took those things, maybe your early childhood experiences, where you saw
I have to quarrel with you on that. I think economists have had a lot of humanism.
The subject
was started by Adam Smith.
Sure.
His first book is The Theory of Moral Sentiment.
Sure.
John Stuart Mill, but even if you look at fairly technical economists, Walras, Wicksell.
That's what I meant. They become more technical.
Then it was Wicksell, for example, makes a remark which Gunnar Myrdal, I think, misunderstand. And he said, the important thing is people keep asking us this model we have about allocation of labor. A laborer is trying to think how much labor to give. There's this utility of work and there's the utility of reward, and he's balancing it. Do I think that that a laborer really thinks exactly like that? Isn't that too sophisticated?
Mm-hmm.
To which Wicksell says, that is the point we're trying to make, that a laborer is a human being in exactly the same way as the academic is who is writing about him.
Mm-hmm.
And to attribute more reasoning to him, I do not apologize for it.
Wonderful.
We are acknowledging something of his humanity, which is being denied by others. That question comes up in the gender context, of course, enormously today.
We will continue this interview in the next podcast.